It's time for a solid hour of business insights and strategies for success on Mind Your Business. And here's your host, the president and founder of Bottom Line Marketing, Yitzhak Saflis.
Welcome back to Mind Your Business, the weekly radio show for business and marketing insights every Sunday from 11 to midnight on 77 WABC Radio. I'm guest host Bill O'Reilly from the November team, a New York-based communications company, and I'm filling in for your regular host, marketing genius Yitzhak Saflis from Bottom Line Marketing, who's off tonight for the holidays. If you're in business and you haven't read Yitzhak's book, So What's the Bottom Line, definitely pick one up. It's chock full of great, easy-to-understand marketing tips. Even I understand them. So What's the Bottom Line by Yitzhak Saflis, great stuff. We've got a couple of terrific guests tonight. First up, Josh Rizak, who's managing director of Rising Group Consulting, the Rising Group. Josh is one of the top turnaround experts anywhere. He's done work in lots in the U.S., in Canada, in Russia, in Ireland. I did work with him in Quito, Ecuador. Overall, great guy, knows everything about business turnarounds. He's going to offer us some insight on where businesses can go wrong a lot of times without even seeing it. I've known Josh for a long, long time. Thank you, Josh Rizak from the Rising Group for being on Mind Your Business. Great to have you on here.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so Josh, what should people know? I mean, we have a lot of small business people out there, or mid-sized business people, or people who want to be, you know, corporate giants. What are some of the pitfalls? I mean, this is what you do for a living. You come in when things have gone sour, but there's got to be some early signs. Like, what should people look for in business and think about for keeping a business stable and growing rather than atrophying?
Well, really, there's two main causes of business failures. One would be, you know, both internal and external reasons. Some of the internal reasons why businesses fail are they don't understand their customers, or they don't have a viable business plan, which is essential not only when you start up a company, but going forward, you always need to know, you know, what your goals and objectives are. They don't have a proven revenue stream. They lack ability to manage. That's probably the number one business failure, is a lack of ability to manage. You know, poor management is the most important factor contributing to business failure. According to a recent study analyzing the underlying internal and external cause of business failure, distresses in the United States, lack of management's ability was the number one reason. You know, you also
Finish up. Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off, Josh.
You know, other things are lack of proper funding, don't keep abreast of their markets, excessive debt, over-dependent on one or two customers, rapidly expanding the business, and some of the external reasons of failure, which are not usually the reasons why business fail, are you know, changes in competitions, mergers, economic factors, technological changes, government constraints, and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, how many businesses make it survive the first couple of years? I haven't seen that data in a long time, but I know, I mean, most of them don't. Is that right? I mean, is that?
Yeah, it's interesting. According to a Bloomberg study, 8 out of 10 entrepreneurs who start businesses fail within the first 18 months. It's a whopping 80% crash and burn.
That's amazing. Yeah.
It's an amazing number, and it's lack of really understanding what your market is, what your competition is, and also having enough funding to execute a proper business plan.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people who have started small businesses. I've done a couple, and you know, I'm in political communications and in corporate communications on the, you know, PR side. And the first time I went in, I knew what I was good at, but I didn't. And thank God the company thrived. But I knew what I was good at, but I didn't really think too far ahead. I didn't plan it out, and I found it very hard. The management part that you're talking about, I found very difficult, you know, delegating, et cetera. Is that a common problem with small businesses that start out?
Yeah, I mean, it's essential to know what your strengths and weaknesses are. And I believe that many people, when they go into business, they believe they're great at everything. And not everybody is great at everything. So where you might be a great marketer or a great, you know, invent center of a product. You might not be so good at marketing that product, or you might not be so good at keeping the financials, or just planning ahead. You know, I had a close friend who had a great company, a great concept, and he got it off the ground and was doing fantastic. And what hurt him the most was that the company expanded so quickly that he couldn't keep up with his orders. So all of a sudden, this was a consumer product. It was available at specialty stores and supermarkets. It was so successful, they were ordering more and more, and he couldn't keep up with his orders. And he didn't have the financing to keep up with his orders. So believe it or not, success can also be a problem. So when you start a company, you have to roll it out in a very controlled manner where you know you can keep up with your orders.
You know, it's funny. You remind me of that, of the TV ad, I forgot who it was for, a couple of years ago, where there's an internet startup and they're looking at the numbers to see what comes in. And it's like one order, two orders, and they're like, yeah. And then it's 20 orders, and they're like, yeah. And then it's like 2,000 orders, and they're like, uh-oh. I remember with starting a PR company where I got too many clients too fast, and that happened to me. And I didn't know how to delegate it. I mean, that's a very small company. Mine is tiny, but that's an important thing. Like, how do you plan that out? But how do you think ahead for that? Do you have to know what the market is ahead of you, or do you have to just make your best guess on early success? Like, how can you plan for that?
Well, you really have to control your rollout of your business or your product. So, for instance, if you have a consumer product, you need to test that in a market and know that you have way more inventory than you think you're going to need. So if it's a success, you have that inventory to fulfill that customer. But what many people do is, instead of going to one or two customers, they'll go to 5, 10, and they'll keep going to more and more customers. And if the product is a real success, you just can't keep up with it. And it's the same in consulting. If you market your services too broadly, and all of a sudden you're a success, you can't take on every client. So, you know, sometimes you just have to say no. And it's much more important to do a great job for a few people and slowly grow out your business than to try to be everything to everybody and then ultimately not be able to service any of your clients.
Right, right. You also talked about before you mentioned over-dependence on one or two customers. I guess that makes sense on its face, but how many businesses fall into that? Where they become a provider of a service or a good to a small niche, and then the niche goes away, which probably happens more and more now in technology, I would imagine. Markets suddenly change.
Again, you know, it's the two-sided coin, right? Here we're saying, you know, don't grow too rapidly. You know, make sure you can service the customers you have. But on the other hand, you don't want to be dependent on one or two customers. So you want to market to a broad group to diversify. But when you're starting out, it's a very difficult thing to diversify and be able to service the customers you have. So you have to go on a very, you know, fine rope and weigh the pros and cons. But as your business grows, you have to make sure as you get out there and become bigger and bigger, that one customer is not 80% or 60% or even 40% of your business. I mean, if you lose one customer that's 40% of your business, that's a huge amount to make up. But if no customer is more than, you know, 5 or 10% of your business and you lose one customer, it won't be so dramatic.
And you come in, you get brought in when companies are in trouble, when they're starting to flail. And you come in as an outsider, and I remember you did this in, I believe it was the timber industry you worked in Russia and diamonds,
right.
Yeah, all kinds of, in Canada. You come in and you've got a pre-existing management team. What's it like? Can companies be hostile to somebody like you that's coming in and telling them what to do, how to stabilize, how to grow, or even how to go through a bankruptcy? What's the culture like when you hit that? Are you the bad guy that comes in for a lot of people?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm often the bad guy, and my role here is to stabilize a company as quickly as possible, and my job is to be there for not only the company, but especially when you go into a bankruptcy, you have a fiduciary duty to all the creditors. So it's a very fine balancing act you have to do when you walk into a troubled situation. And you need the support of management because you need their help in getting the information. You got to remember, I'm thrown into a brand new situation. I know no one there. I know very little about the company. If it's public, there's a little bit more information. If it's private, you really have nothing. And you have to quickly find out what the issues are with the company, what the financials are of the company. Are the financials, are they good financials, are they bad financials? And you, it's imperative that I get these people on my side and working with me. So often, you know, the biggest role or the person I'm dealing with the most would be the CFO of the company, the chief financial officer, and dealing with the financials, getting my hands around that and understanding that. Now, often we come into a situation where the management, this is awful. But you can't just get rid of them overnight. You have to phase them out over time because you need them to get this turnaround done. So unless there's major fraud, or, you know, you find out the CEO or the president was doing, you know, things that are unethical, where you just literally have to fire them on the spot. But then you rely on people below them to help you with this turnaround. But a turnaround is not done by one person alone.
Do they not want to face it? Like, you know, like you sit there, like I'll get bills stacking up at home sometimes, and I don't want to look at them. It's like, I'm not opening the mail. It's like lined up. I see it's credit card bills, the mortgage thing comes in, everything lines up, and you just don't want to acknowledge it. It's a human instinct for some people. Do you find that in business also, where people that are in trouble just don't want to face it?
Absolutely. You find it all the time. They're in denial. One of the big things you'll find in a lot of companies, and I've seen this from the smallest to the largest corporations out there, where they're in trouble, but what they'll do is instead of not paying a bill, they write the check for that payable, and then they put these checks in the drawer, and all of a sudden they have a stack of checks. So if you look at the accounts payable, what you owe to people, it looks like, oh, it's not so bad. But then you find out that there's, you know, 1,000, 1,500, 100 checks sitting in the drawer that haven't been mailed out. So it comes off their accounts payable, but they still owe the money. And this is a very dangerous thing to do because you don't know where you are at any given moment. So they're in denial, but they think, oh, but I've cut the check, and then they slowly release the checks. Well, that works for a little while, but when somebody's owed, let's say they're 30 days past due, it works. And then they become 45 and 60, and people usually work with you. But then when it becomes 90, 120 days, and people now are getting very anxious, they're getting pissed, and then there's ramifications from not paying your bills. Just as in your home business or at home, if you don't pay your phone bill, they don't cut you off right away. They let you go two bills past, and then they cut you off. Well, that will happen in a business also. So you have to be upfront when you have a problem, and it's any problem in life. You got to deal with it heads on, and you know, and come to a resolution and figure out.
The sooner the better, right? Yeah,
absolutely. The sooner the better. The longer you wait, the harder it is. There's so many times I've been brought into companies, and I say, "Wow, if you just only brought me in 3 months before." I mean, I've been brought into situations where I start on a Monday. Payroll's due on Wednesday, and nobody has any idea how we're going to make payroll. They're like, there's no way we can make payroll. And, you know, the minute you stop paying people, you have real problems.
Yeah. We're talking to Josh Rizak, who's the managing director of the Rising Group Consulting, which is a top turnaround firm. This is Mind Your Business on 77 WABC Radio. Josh, what is the you've been doing this, what, 25 years? 20 years? I've known you for a long time.
Yeah, I think over 25 years.
Over 25 years. I don't mean to date you, but what is with the change in technology? Things seem to, you know, companies seem to go up and go down faster than they used to. I don't know if that's true. You know, you look at BlackBerry's market share is the famous example in recent years, but there are hundreds of them. Do you find that true? Do companies get obsolete or get knocked out of a market faster than when you started?
Well, yeah. That happens, but that happens because management doesn't have their eye on the ball. Look, life is always changing. Things are always changing. I mean, you know, whether it's consumer products, electronics, telephones, whatever, things change. And you have to keep on top of your market. You have to understand what your customer wants, and you have to keep changing with them. I mean, if you look at Apple, for example, the iPhone, every time they come out with a new iPhone, everybody's like, you know what, Apple's done. You know, they're not going to bring me anything new, nothing exciting. You know, my iPhone's good. And then, you know, they put out one and it's okay. And then the next one is always great, right? Because they're always looking to what their consumer wants and what technology can do. And even with this new phone, which, you know, the new iPhone that just came out, right? It has small advances, but, you know, at first, you know, when I spoke to my kids, oh, I'm not going to be able to put my headphones in there anymore. I go, but it's going to be a much thinner phone, and it's going to be waterproof, and aren't these great things you want? How many times have you dropped your phone in the pool? So they're looking ahead at what the consumer wants. And when the phone came out, it was a huge success. So, you know, it's following your market and your customers and staying ahead. And I think one of, you know, you brought up the BlackBerry. They didn't keep ahead of the curve. I mean, Apple just passed them, and originally they were it. Everybody used the BlackBerry. They had a great product, but
I'm still mourning over here. I'm mourning the loss. I've got the last BlackBerry Priv, which is maybe the last one that they make out of Waterloo, Canada. And but you're right. I mean, they got passed fast.
Got passed. And that's what happens now. So you can't sit back and say, hey, I did a great job in the past, and I'll do a great job in the future. You have to constantly work with your people, look outside your company, look at what other people are doing, look at trends out there, and you need to keep ahead of things.
Yeah, and we're talking to listeners in, you know, mostly throughout the tri-state area. That may work for a very small company, a very large company. They could be in a Fortune 50 or in between. But what would you say specifically to people that are listening, where the conversation about avoiding problems hits home most? Somebody who may own a small store, a mom and pop shop, or a small service company, and they may be feeling like maybe they're getting behind, and there's anxiety out there, which so many Americans have both personally and professionally these days. What would you say that they should be watching for? The little signs that they're in trouble, the real practical stuff, and what should they do to face it? What are some of the tricks that they could do? You know, cash flow things, just practical things.
Right. Well, you know, what are the signs? What are the warning signs of business failures? And you know, some of the very obvious things are sales. You know, all of a sudden your sales are not what they were. You have a shortfall to your plan. Also, your margins aren't as big as they were before. Your cost might be going up. Your sales, your general administrative costs increasing. Expense, you know, you're overspending on cars or office expenses. Or
it's going to be expense. That minimum wage hit's going to really kill a lot of small businesses. It's gone up 70% in New York State, which, you know, it's nice if you have a job and you get that money, but a lot of people aren't going to get the jobs now because businesses are going to close or automate. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you've been to Europe, I was recently in Spain. My daughter was studying there. And you walk into a McDonald's in Spain, and there's nobody at the counter to help you. There's these huge, beautiful automated screens, and it has the menu on there, and you hit a button for whatever you want to order, and you put your credit card in or your cash. So all they need is people preparing the food. They no longer need the counter help. And you know, it's a two-sided coin again. You know, you raise the minimum wage too high, and then automation comes in. But you know, on the other hand, people do need to have a cost of living that they can live on.
Right, exactly.
So it's really two-sided. But, you know, these are some of the things you have to look at. So they've been announcing that minimum wages are going up in many jurisdictions, in particular New York. So as a company, you have to, you know, look at your business and say, how is that going to affect my business? You know, if I have to start paying people, $14, $15 an hour, what does that do to my bottom line? And how can I adjust that? And can I raise prices to my customers? Or if I raise prices, are people just going to say, I'm going to go elsewhere, or I'm not going to buy this product anymore? So you need to figure out what you can do and can't do and make adjustments. And that may include automation. It may include, you know, figuring out how to do things cheaper, how to get expenses at how to get cost out of the product, and so forth. So again, this all comes down to management. Okay, management is what runs the business, and management is what makes or breaks a company. So, you know, I always say, you know, companies don't get into trouble. They're managed into trouble because management's not looking at the future and is not looking at the bottom line and is not looking at all the tools they have and understanding what's good and what's bad. You know, like I said, companies don't get in trouble overnight. It could be a 1 to 2 year process. So if they were watching what was going on with their company, if they were watching what's going on, not both internally and externally, they would understand and see the problems and be able to deal with them before they become huge problems.
Yeah, I think a lot of small business owners, me being one of them, would say, where do you get the time? I mean, I'm a small business owner, and I spend all my time, you know, advising clients on communications, marketing, public relations, et cetera, political and corporate and not-for-profits, and almost no time thinking about the November team, my own business, and thinking about, you know, where is it going to end up in 5 or 10 years? I'm just so consumed in the day-to-day work for clients that I don't think about my company. Is that something that you find common? Do you just have to make the time? Is it a change in thinking that you need to have or develop?
Yeah, it's discipline. You have to have disciplines. And you have to constantly look at how your company's doing. You know, just because you're busy and your people are busy doesn't mean you're making money, right? Maybe you're not charging enough. Maybe your clients aren't paying you. You know, having your own business means you have responsibility not only for you know, doing your consulting business, but also for collecting the receivables, paying your payables, paying your bills, understanding, you know, your technology and is your technology working? What would happen tomorrow if all your phones and computers went dead and you couldn't communicate with your customers, with your clientele? I mean, you have to have plans and you have to deal with things that are going to happen. And you also have to monitor how you're doing. You know, are you profitable? And if you're not profitable, how do we make ourselves profitable? Because you don't want to find out in 2 weeks from now that, hey, you know, you forgot to send out your bills or you didn't pay attention to your billing to your customers and you didn't collect your money. And now all of a sudden you can't pay your payroll or you have to go into your own pocket to pay your employees. So you've got to take the time to watch your business and understand your business and make sure all the different parts of your business are working well.
And do you have benchmarks for people starting businesses on how much cash that they should have available to them going in? Is there a set number for that, or it depends on the industry?
Well, it depends on the industry and their business, and it's essential that you write a really thorough business plan. A lot of people are like, you know, I know what I want to do. I know how to do it. I go, yeah, but do you know what your costs really are? And often people are like, yeah, I know what it costs to, you know, do this. I go, well, do you have insurance in there? Oh, no, I forgot that. You know, I said, do you have, you know, your copier machine and your repairs and maintenance for that? Oh, no, I don't have that. And all these little things add up. So you need to really take the time to write out your business plan and to come up with a financial model for 5 years and really a detailed model for the month by month for the first year. So you really and then you need to have that vetted by people to make sure you have really thought it out.
You're not lying to yourself, right? Right.
Yeah, and you're not right. And you know, anybody can make a financial model work, right? You can make it say whatever you want it to say. That's why it's essential that you have other people vet it and look at it and challenge you on the different numbers so that you go in there with your eyes wide open and that you can figure out cash. And, you know, it's interesting. When I go into these large companies, small companies, and you know, one of the first things we put together is called a 13-week cash flow. And it's a very simple spreadsheet. It's literally cash in and cash out. So we can understand for the next 13 weeks what our needs are. You know, are we going to have a problem in week 4 when payroll's due? We have our bank payment due on week 7. Do we have enough money for that? And now we can sit there and adjust and say, you know what? Well, if we don't pay these bills this week, and we'll have enough for payroll, and then after payroll, we can pay those bills. And this tool, I encourage people to use going forward when their business is healthy so they understand what their cash needs are in the short term. Because it's essential in the first part of a workout is the short term, is the first 30 days, understanding what needs to be done and having enough money to get through that crisis phase. And you know, I call that, you know, the crisis phase is literally cash in is greater than cash out. So you literally you have to control every dollar and understand how you're going to spend that so that you're prepared and that you can take care of your essential needs.
Yeah, Josh Rizak from the Rising Group Consulting Group. Thank you so much for being on Mind Your Business. I'd love you to come on again when I'm guest hosting for Yitzhak Saflis, if you could, because I'd love to talk in detail about how people can dig out of the mess in specifics, because I think it's really valuable information, and not everybody, frankly, can afford a turn. I mean, a lot of companies can, but a lot of small companies can't afford a turnaround expert like you. And so you're giving them advice here is usually appreciated. So thank you. We're going to take a break now. When we come back, we're going to talk to one of the country's leading HR experts about the do's and don'ts of hiring or getting a job. This is Mind Your Business on 77 WABC Radio. We'll be right back.
Your company website is crucial to your success, providing information about your company to the entire world. Was your website recently updated? Is it mobile-friendly? And does it have the 2016 look? Well, look no further than WebsiteWithBrains.com, the complete website solution. Call Website with Brains today at 718-412-3500. That's 718-412-3500. Or visit WebsiteWithBrains.com. The experienced team at Website with Brains will plan, write, design, and program a stunning and informative website that combines simplicity and flexibility. Best of all, Website with Brains can have your new website up and running within 4 to 6 weeks. Get ready to look great online and take your business to the next level. See some of the attractive, user-friendly sites built by Website with Brains by visiting WebsiteWithBrains.com. Then give Website with Brains a call at 718-412-3500. That's 718-412-3500.
Welcome back to Mind Your Business on 77 WABC Radio. I'm guest host Bill O'Reilly of the November team, and I'm filling in for a marketing genius, the incomparable Yitzhak Saflis of Bottom Line Marketing, who's on for the holiday. Yitzhak will be back next week. We're now joined by one of the country's top human resources executives, Jim Viola. Jim runs HR nationally for Party City, an HR exec at lots of places, including Saks Fifth Avenue, Lord & Taylor. He basically knows everything there is to know about hiring, grooming employees, building a winning team, etc. Jim, before I introduce you or put you on, I've got to just give a plug to Party City. I become a hero every few weeks when I go down there for just a few bucks. I can come back and make my house look great. My kids go crazy. But I've got to say that the employees there are so on the ball and so good. And I know that as a result of your work largely. I was at another retail chain store last weekend, and it was so bad that you can't help notice the difference. And so someone up top is doing that, and I know that's people like you. So I just wanted to give you a kudos. Welcome to Mind Your Business, Jim Viola. Thanks for coming.
Well, great to be here, Bill, and thank you for the compliment. We work hard at providing good service for our customers and keeping folks like you coming back.
Yeah, so HR, if you could, if you could explain to listeners basically what HR is for those who don't know it, and then we could talk a little bit about being on both sides of the desk, those hiring and those looking for jobs. But what does HR entail? It's a lot more than just hiring and managing, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. People sometimes think of it as the old personnel department from years ago, right? Hiring, firing, filling out forms and applications and things of that nature. But today's human resources really is the epicenter of a company, because truly the biggest differentiator in business today is the people that work for you, right? So, you know, to kind of boil it down is, you know, it's really about talent. Now you do have to do all the basics right, and you have to be able to get people, you know, into your systems and hired and onboarded and all that good stuff. But quite frankly, the work of the work is really building a talent culture and a culture that people want to work in and where people can excel and do their very best. So we focus on having the right talent, all right, in the right job at the right time, and building a culture where people feel valued, empowered, and have all the tools and resources to really do their job in the very end, impress every customer that comes in the door.
Yeah, it's just so notable. I'm not going to mention the chain that I experienced last week, and it's not the first time I've had the impression. But it's a major national kind of office related chain, and he walked in and there was somebody at the counter, you know, talking on the cell phone, couldn't care less about the employee. About the customer, you walk in and you feel unwelcome. You feel like they couldn't care less about you. The store is dirty, and then you walk into a Party City or to another chain of whatever type of, and I'm talking retailers, and it's, you know, hi, welcome to Party City, and everything is clean and the aisles are done. It makes such a difference as a consumer. It's amazing. I know that's part of what you do is train people. But what I'd love to talk about, Jim Viola, is what's out there, like for the people looking for work now or looking to advance in the field. How do you get a job? Like, how do you get a good one? It used to be when I came out of school, it was make sure your shoes were polished and do a one page resume, which is, you know, I'm 53, that dates me. But what's the name of the game now? How do you get noticed? How do you get hired?
Yeah, that's a great point, Bill. And it's changed quite a bit since you and I were beating the pavement looking for jobs years ago, right? So, you know, it used to be waiting for the Sunday paper and looking through the classifieds, if you can remember that far back. But in today's environment, it's so much more complex. So, you know, yes, you still have to have a resume. Everyone needs to have a resume. And, you know, it's not just a piece of paper. It's a marketing tool, right? It's a way to tell a story about yourself, to get interest. So that still exists. And it really doesn't matter whether it's one page or two page or three pages. You know, in today's environment, you're typically not even sending your resume to a person anymore, unless, of course, you know someone inside the company and they're going to pass it on for you. Today's business environment use applicant tracking systems. And I know that sounds scary to some, but basically, if you go to any company's website, you have the ability to apply online. And I would say probably 90% of the hiring is done that way today, right? So it's very impersonal. You're going in, filling out an online application.
They're looking for keywords. Is that, I mean, like that type of thing?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You got it right on the dot there. So when you apply, you're not only filling out all this information and attaching your resume, the computer system is really kind of matching you against a job profile, which is made up of keywords, right? So, the best match usually, you know, gets pulled out of the stack of hundreds or thousands of applications, and then perhaps somebody like a recruiter would go through those hundred of resumes and narrow them down to a handful for the hiring manager to look at. So you got to think about that when you're marketing yourself, right? Do I have the right keywords, you know, and do I have the right skills and experience that match this role that I'm looking for? And that's very important.
Do people catch on and all start using the same keywords? I remember writing resumes for people, and they say always say leadership or vision or teamwork. You know, is it that kind of thing still?
Well, you know what? That's interesting, right? And it's not. It's not. And I'll tell you why. Because so often the jobs are unique at different companies. So there's one, right? And the second is the culture is different at any company. And quite frankly, the biggest opportunity for folks is to you know, match up to the culture of the company. So it's best to kind of look at the annual report, look at what you see online, find what the company stands for in terms of their key values, their, you know, what's in their mission. And then those are the keywords that you want to use so that you can prove you're a cultural fit first and foremost. And then particularly for the job, there are definitely things that get emphasized at different companies. And you can usually find that by reading the job description very carefully, and pulling out what you see the words are that they're using.
Yeah, that's a great point. Do most companies, mid or larger size companies, do most of them have missions or philosophies? Is that kind of built into the companies now?
Yeah, for the most part, right? Most good companies have an overarching strategy or mission that they're trying to achieve. So often that becomes a marketing tool. It's a brand statement. But you have to dig a little bit deeper beyond that. And you can usually get that, you know, from their website, their investor relations site, you know, or their annual report, because they go into a little bit more detail about what it is they're trying to do from a business strategy point of view. So, very easily accessible.
It seems like, well, I'll get young people that will approach my company, which is political and corporate communications, and I'll get some, you know, emails. They've come in and they could tell they've gone through the website and a few other things. I notice a lot of young people now have their own websites where it will be, you know, johnsmith.com or whatever it might be, with everything you need to know about it. And then there's lots of obviously social media things. How much is like it's like each individual is now marketing himself or herself through the various, you know, available channels. Is that the name of the game? Is that where we are? Like, do you have to go LinkedIn? Do you have to do that whole routine?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, that was really going to be my second point for listeners around what it takes to get a job. You have to have a social presence out there. And when I say that, people often get confused. It sounds a little scary. I've got to be online. No, it doesn't mean you have to have your own blog or your own, you know, your own website. But you do have to be on the mainstream sites like LinkedIn. If you're a professional or even if you're a college student, you need to have a LinkedIn profile. And that's how business folks kind of put out there, you know, what they're all about, right? What's their current role? What have they achieved in their past? What's their experience? So not so different than a resume online. It's not as detailed, but, you know, keywords, key achievements, and then all the relevant experience that you've had in your career and in college. But it doesn't stop there, Bill, right? Because LinkedIn is very smart in the way they approach it. So you have to have a picture, right? So you have to have a professional looking picture as well, so people can start to identify who you are and what you've done. There's groups, right? So again, when a company is looking for a prospective hire, they're looking for leaders, right? So they're, you know, the fact that you have the word leadership or leader in your profile does nothing. It's the proof is in the pudding, right? So they're able to see the different groups that you're involved with. They're able to see, you know, the boards that you might be on. They're able to see, you know, the LinkedIn groups that you are, you know, like community chats, right, where you're sharing professional experience or sharing your work. There's opportunities to kind of post some of your work on there as well, so people can get a real feeling for what you've done.
But people like you are digging down that deep. They're actually going in and looking to see.
Oh, absolutely.
See what chats you're involved in, what you care about, what you volunteer for. I mean, they're really looking that deep.
Yeah, they're looking that deep. And so different companies will look at different things, but I will tell you, you know, the way social networking works, right? So if you think about years ago, people used to say you have to network to get a job. It's still true today, right? But years ago, you'd call your friends that you know, right? Or you'd try to call into a company and try to make a connection. Today, so much of that is done online, right? So through LinkedIn, you can connect with other folks who are connected to people in your network. So the bigger your network, it multiplies. So you have the ability to connect with folks that your friends and your network knows. You have the ability to share.
Jim, I'm going to ask you the dumbest question, because I joined LinkedIn years ago, and then I had Facebook, I had Twitter, I have all these different things, and I was like, I don't want to do them all. So I tried to quit LinkedIn 8 years ago, and I couldn't figure out how to get out of it. So I stayed up there, and then all these people are trying to to link with me that I don't know. Why are they doing that? Why do they do that? Do you want to get as many friends as you can get? Does that look, you know, impressive to a hiring person?
Yes. Yeah. The bigger you network, sometimes, it certainly can mean more opportunity or the more influential a person is. But, you know, folks that reach out that don't know others, you know, that's not a way to get linked in with folks, because myself, I get hundreds of those. And unless they are referred to me through others or I've had a connection with them at a conference or a lunch or a dinner or something like that, I usually won't connect with them. Right. So you got to be very, you know, skilled at building your network. You don't have to say yes to everyone just because they look to LinkedIn. So
right.
You got to be careful about that, right? It's like who do you surround yourself with says a lot about you, right? Birds of a feather, if you will.
Yeah. Yep. So the
best part about that is, though, through your network, you're sharing ideas or you're liking articles or you're sharing, you know, philosophies. And I think just like Facebook, you know, people can like those, people can reshare them or retweet them. And those are the kinds of things that I think employers spend more time looking at than maybe where you volunteer, right?
Okay,
so what are your interests?
Yeah. Can you talk to the downside of that? Like, can you talk to the, you know,
sure.
the lampshade on the head at that party, you know, in Tulsa in 94, like on Facebook? Like, does that, you know, that's always what people say. Don't put it on Facebook. An employer is going to see it. Is that real? Are they really going to see it?
Yeah, absolutely. So not only, you know, are they looking at LinkedIn, they're looking, they're Googling you. You know what I mean? I got my recruiting teams. They will Google you and see what comes up, right? So, you know, it's a way to weed out potential fraud. Right? Are people who they say they are? Do they have that lampshade picture? You know, or have they said some inappropriate or, comments or have done some things they're not proud of, right? And that tells you whether or not they're a cultural fit for your company. Guess what? Some of those people are cultural fits for certain kind of companies. But, you know, for the most part, Fortune 500 firms really want to protect their brand and their image and who they hire. So, yeah, they're looking.
Yeah, it sounds like at least for the bigger companies, these are pretty robust HR departments. You've got to have, you really got to, if you're going to be going down that far for employees, you must have a decent sized team working with you.
Well, different companies have different investments in their human resources team, but it's one of the growing positions. It's one of the growing departments inside of company today. If you look at the trends in business, I mean, the IT departments, the human resource departments, the marketing analytical departments are really where you're seeing the growth, because people have recognized the value of that kind of information in making smart business and people decisions. So, yeah, I mean, are you going to look at, Google for every, retail sales associate? Probably not. But guess what? If you're the general manager who's the hiring manager in that store, you've had issues before, you just might Google them, right? So it's not just a team of HR people who are interested. It's hiring managers everywhere.
Yeah, I was going to ask that for smaller companies out there, for, you know, small business owners, whether it's a store owner or a small, you know, a service firm that isn't able to have an HR department. What should they be looking for in employees? What questions should they ask themselves as they're looking at the stack of resumes?
Yeah, that's a great question, Bill. And first, you know, what I will say is the difference between HR and line leaders is significant. So an owner, a small business owner, a small company, they don't have HR departments. And HR is really just a facilitator in helping leaders, you know, hire, retain, and develop people. Most of that is done by the leadership. So a business owner is usually the HR department themselves, right? They're the ones responsible for the hiring and retention and development of the people. So, you know, HR is a facilitator. But secondly, what I'll say on that is, what should they be looking for? And I'll tell you, first and foremost, you know, is this a person I like and I can work with that fits my values, our company's values? You know, if that question is no, then pass, right? You know, right. The second component really, you know, is, you know, can this person do the job, you know, that I want, and can they serve my customers the way I want? So in a very customer service type environment, you got to have somebody who's friendly, who wants to deal with customers, right? Who wants to delight customers. You know, by hiring someone who's not, you know, interested in that, or doesn't, you know, have the outward or, you know, capabilities or the ability to smile and greet people, then you know what? It's never going to be a match. So I think they got to ask those questions, you know, around the values of the company. That's where
I would think it would be a lot smarter or a lot easier to put the work in on the front end before you hire somebody and then have to get rid of them. I'm sorry to go back to the sales associate analogy, but it's just so striking. I remember there's a major American printing company, a printer and computer maker that had a sales associate on the phone years ago that was so nasty that I never bought from them again. It's, you know, it seems better to make sure you got the right person than to hire the person and then have to fire them. Is that, I imagine that's right.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the decisions you make up front have lasting impact on your business. And, you know, when you have to let someone go, you know, it takes time. You do it with respect, but it's costly to the business, both on, you know, from a sales perspective. If the person makes some, you know, very big mistakes, it can cost you customers, it can cost you profit or loss. So yeah, the decisions up front really are the most important ones, and it's worthwhile making, you know, sure that you go through all the diligence in vetting a candidate, seeing multiple people for jobs, and really making a decision, you know, that the person can work and excel in the kind of company you've built.
Jim Viola, what would you say to people who feel kind of stuck, you know, dead end in a job, and they want to go out there and test the market and see what's out there and check their viability for a better position, but don't want to get caught? they don't want their boss to see they're out there shopping. Is that still a factor, or is everybody shopping now? Is it the world
that
where
is,
you've
that
got
is
it?
So, that is so interesting you asked that. You're right. It really isn't like that today, Bill. I was at a dinner the other night with HR professionals, and this question came up. And even to me, I thought the answer was so interesting. I think the gentleman asked the question, and he was from a leading, you know, job board provider. And the question was, how many folks today out there, you know, that are employed, well, not actually employed, but are in the job market, are passive job seekers, right? Are passive candidates, because companies love to hire passive candidates, and that means people who are working, right? Because
that's interesting. I never thought about that. So they want people that are secure in their jobs already.
Yeah, you want the person who – it's always been the case, you want the person that's not looking, right? And that you can't get. And you can only get through networking and digging into a company and finding the very best person who's great at their job, happy where they're at. Those are the people you always salivated over. Well, guess
yeah,
what?
The girls, today, the girls in high school that I couldn't get, you know?
Outstanding. Well, I don't know that we figured that one out, but I will tell you the answer to the question is more than 80% of the people that are hired today are active job seekers. And what that simply means is everyone is in the marketplace for the most part, or the majority. And that means if you're looking at a job board, if you're on LinkedIn, if you're sharing, you know, information, you know, out there, if someone calls you for a job or you see a job posted, you know, and you have it, you read it. You're an active job seeker. And so there isn't that kind of, you know, mark about you anymore, because I think, you know, it's a free agency, right? Everyone is really their own, and creates their own market. Loyalty isn't what it used to be.
Don't blame me. They saw me on LinkedIn, you know.
That's right. That's right. And your boss is on LinkedIn, and your boss is getting calls, and your boss is, you know, noticing a job that's posted here, or has a friend who calls him about an opportunity. So everyone is in the market. So it doesn't have that stigma today, Bill. And I would encourage everyone to be out there, right? So, you know, not to necessarily post your resume on a job board, but certainly to have a LinkedIn profile, to be active in the marketplace, and just to know what's out there, right? Loyalty isn't what it is today, what it once was, right? Where probably someone like your father would work, you know, for a company for 30, 40 years and never change jobs. Today, especially millennials, they're changing jobs every year, 2 years, 3 years. And it's about acquiring experience. So I think that's how the market is changing, and we're going to see much more of that down the road.
Yeah, what besides LinkedIn? I became aware of it as a hiring site. I had a client who was the founder of a political candidate at one point, who was the founder of a very big job site that people would know. And he said, LinkedIn's going to eat us all alive at the end of the day. And besides LinkedIn, where else do you need to be? Or is that the name of the game today?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. There are so many boutique job boards out there. And the big ones from the 90s and 2000s are still around, and they're still viable. But Facebook, Instagram, Facebook is a huge one. Google, right? I mean, jobs are being scraped like someone like an Indeed, you know, is a job scrape. It scrapes all the possible jobs from around the world, around the company, and it prioritizes them like a Google search would, and puts them right in front of you. So, you know, having your resume out there with a job board or with Indeed, you know, you'll be able to see thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs, and you will be an active candidate in the marketplace for people who might be looking for those skill sets.
Yeah, so, I didn't. It's called Indeed. I'm not even aware of it. Indeed.
Indeed. Yes. Indeed.
I've never heard of it, but I'll take a look. Yeah.
Don't underestimate Facebook.
Yep.
Yeah, don't underestimate things like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You know, those are the mainstream social media platforms today, and people are tweeting their jobs. People are sharing and liking jobs and liking companies and following companies. And I can't even tell you I understand it to the degree. You ask any millennial, they probably could tell you a little bit more about where to be and where to see the jobs. But I'm telling you from a corporate perspective that social media platforms are becoming the biggest and most viable options for learning about opportunities.
It's amazing. You talk about just the number of connections. I do a column a couple of days a week for Newsday, a political column, and somebody approached me about doing a book. And he said, but you got to get your Twitter followers up. And I think it's, you know, I've got 2,500 or something like that. And he's like, you got to get into the 50, 60, 70,000 followers. And it was,
wow.
I was just so struck by it. Not so much by the number, which was daunting, but just the fact that that's how some publishers are deciding who to go with, is who's following whom, you know? And I'm 53, and I've managed to keep up in the political industry with all the emerging technology, and I always stay ahead of it. But I still feel like 153 sometimes, just for how the personal marketing's going, you know, is being done today. And I mean, this is the world you live in, Jim.
This is the world we live in. That does sound daunting, though, the size of the following that you have to have. But it's a populist culture, I guess, and that's what drives it.
Okay, could you talk, Jim, can you talk just very briefly, we only have a couple of minutes, to the person who's having a hard time getting a job, who's out there and just is not making it, doesn't have a social media presence. What are the things he or she should be doing outside the job market to look enticing to somebody like you?
Yeah, well, I guess the advice I give a lot of folks is first and foremost, you know, find a job that you love. If you do what you love, you never work a day in your life, right? So I think it starts with figuring out what it is you like to do, and then where are those opportunities, right? So you have a direction. The second thing is then once you do that, really build your network, right? Get introduced to folks, you know, at those places or in that industry, you know, acquire skills and experience, even the littlest bit, right? So, you know, in a lot of ways there are internships, but for folks who have been, you know, looking to change a career, you know, volunteer. Right. Go online, you know, take a class, you know, sign up for webinars or, you know, that are offered that are free and do something, you know, to acquire those skills and knowledge so that when you talk to someone, even if it's a friendly conversation, you have the ability to, you know, to kind of use that as a hook. And then get on social media. Don't be scared of it. You know, you don't have to publish a book and you don't have to, you know, have, all the knowledge, but you can join a conversation or join a group and learn from the folks, you know, that are doing those roles today.
That's great. That's great advice. Jim Viola, we got to run. Thank you so much for being on and for all your insight. Also want to thank again, Josh Rizak of the Rising Group. You know, both of you guys have given us a lot to think about and to do, action items. We hope you've all enjoyed this week's Mind Your Business. Your regular host, Yitzhak Saplis of Bottom Line Marketing, will be back next week. I'm Bill O'Reilly from the November team. Thank you for letting me guest host. And for Mind Your Business and 77 WABC Radio, have a great night.
77 WABC Radio presents Mind Your Business, hosted by founder and president of Bottom Line Marketing Group, Yitzhak Saflis. Every Sunday night from 11 until midnight on Mind Your Business.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.